The proposed bill would impose an additional requirement for the service of process in the event that the registered agent cannot be located or if there's no registered office. Now, I submit that that is an additional imposition upon the creditors of a corporation, which I question whether is necessary given the fact that the corporation is the one who's required by law as a condition to coming into existence to establish a named person as a registered agent and an office where he can be located. Section 210, for example, requires, this has already been mentioned incidentally, but it requires items to be contained in the articles of incorporation which are presently contained in the bylaws. Here again, you've heard other witnesses testify as to the increase in cost to start up a corporation, and my estimation is that it probably would increase the initial legal fees either two or threefold. And one thing, one observation I would like to make, and I think it's necessary that you keep this in perspective, I have not done a statistical analysis, but it is my opinion that the majority of corporations in this state consist of three or fewer stockholders, and that the majority of those corporations have a commonality of stockholders, directors, and the managers, or the officers. Section 230, frankly, I find too complicated for the average person to understand. I read it lightly myself last night. I'm not saying that I couldn't thoroughly comprehend it if I spent the time and went through it line by line, but...
Excuse me, sir. What section?
Section 230. There, for example, I suspect that if that section ever raised any issues, that would be resolved by litigation, that the courts would spend quite some time and probably a number of cases would have to be taken up before that could be decided. At the present time, the statute is very simple, and I don't find anything unworkable about it. It allows the number of directors, if less than three, to be equal to the number of shareholders in the corporation. The formula is straightforward, and I'm not aware of any particular problems with it, at least in the clients that I've represented. Section 233, for example, I find too burdensome. Many corporations at the present time maintain one set of books and records, and it's in the registered agent's office. For about half of the corporations I represent, I keep the books and records in my office. As a matter of present law, the records are required to be available to any shareholder upon request. If they request the president or the registered agent for a copy permission to review the corporate records, the person at this time, if he doesn't have them, is required to tell him where they are. And, for example, any shareholder who calls my office and says, I want to see the records of so-and-so, is entitled to do so as a matter of law, and you can come in my conference room and do it. Sections 358 through 383 are extremely complicated. In my opinion, if those sections were enacted, they're basically going to open the door to countless lawsuits as compared to the present law. I am not one of those persons who advocates anything which will cause attorneys to have more work and earn more money from their clients. I like to see the least complicated statutes possible and the least amount of litigation. I think these sections are going to open the door for litigation for years to come. Section 450, for example, is another one that is a radical change from the existing financial and legal philosophy. Section 450, in my interpretation, would impose liability on directors for negligence and judgment. Traditionally, the corporate directors have always been shielded from misjudgment, from mismanagement even, as long as that was not done in bad faith. And I submit that this is going to change the philosophy within the business community, and also it's going to open the door for a large number of lawsuits. Section 488, which of course is the one that probably has gotten the most attention, the secondary liability allowing the piercing of the corporate veil. I think that the effect of this particular section would be to definitely dampen entrepreneurism. The way it works at the present time, if a small risky venture is starting, and many small ventures are risky, and the stockholders are willing to put a certain amount of money into this. As an example, a service that is needed, or at least as people perceive as being needed in the community, might require an investment initially of $50,000. Two people who want to start this business are each willing to put up $25,000. But they're certainly not willing to put up any more because they don't know whether the business is going to fly or not. The only way they're going to find out is to get in, really, and try. But they're willing to make that much of a risk. The business can get started up, for example, and it might do extremely well. It's good for the people who started it, it's good for the community, and it's good for the suppliers that these people deal with. At the present time, if in fact it turns out for whatever reason that the business was not there or it was a bad gamble, the risk of that failure is spread among, for example, creditors, many of whom probably include outside suppliers, the type of people I represent. And just because I represent that type of people doesn't mean that I'm advocating their position. What I'm telling you is that, in my opinion, you're going to be shifting the risk of failure from the people who supply this operation and who, in fact, know the risk they're taking at the present time when they extend credit to a small corporation to the directors or the managers. And then the question I think this group has to ask is whether or not you want to make that radical a change in the present philosophies. So basically, that's all I have to say. I would just want the members to be aware of the radical changes. In my opinion, they're radical departures from the existing statutes and philosophies.
Well, thank you. Representative Wimpy?
You indicated, going into your testimony, you represented both sides of that equation.
Both the creditors and the small business,
your
small
judgment,
corporation.
Should we make that shift of risk in relation to the creditor?
In my personal judgment, no.
Your judgment is that the risk should remain with the creditor?
With some exceptions. Now, the workers' comp problem has been brought out. I would treat that not as a shifting of responsibility, but I think the appropriate place to look at the workers' comp situation is a change in the workers' comp law. It's entirely possible that that's one area where liability should be imposed on directors and managers. But that's a special instance. That's an instance where a form of insurance is required by law to be obtained, and there you would be having a specific sanction for failure to do something that's already required. I see that as a different situation from protection of general creditors.
Thank you. On my question I asked about the corporate shield of some foreign corporation, do you think that could be penetrated, stockholders of a foreign corporation under this?
Yes, I do. There again, this is not based on a thorough reading and a thorough analysis of the bill. The question that should be addressed, in my opinion, is whether or not there is any reason or any need to treat foreign corporations or stockholders of foreign corporations differently from domestic corporations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jameson, one of the concerns is that officers and directors of some foreign corporation may be outside of the jurisdiction of the Alaska court. Do you see this as posing a potential threat?
Not really. They are subject to the foreign corporation is subject to jurisdiction of this court if the corporation is doing business in Alaska.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. I should refer specifically to the secondary liability.
Secondary liability?
Right, and being able to hold the officers and directors of a foreign corporation who may not be subject to the jurisdiction of the Alaska court. I should clarify that.
All right. Now you're asking a lawyer to do something that he never likes to do, which is to give a legal opinion off the top of his head. My opinion, my initial opinion or impression is that probably should this statute be passed, Alaska would have jurisdiction over the directors or people personally through our long-arm statute. There again, that's going to take some case law to determine specifically, and I'm sure that it would be challenged, and the state Supreme Court ultimately would rule on whether or not there was personal jurisdiction or not.
Are there further questions from Representative Liskett?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Henderson, I sure thank you for your input on this, very thorough. The way I read what you're trying to tell us is that this is so radical, this piece of legislation, that we will have no case law to back it up. So we're going to end up with we're inviting a lot of lawsuits. Is this the way I'm reading you?
Well, there again, like my predecessors, I don't claim to be an expert on the corporate codes of the other states, but from reading the comments that and the letter of transmittal from the Code Revision Commission to the chairman, I get the impression that even though New York and California are considering revisions to their corporate code, they haven't adopted this statute or this code at the present time, and nobody knows whether they will or not. So at the present time, it's my understanding that if this were adopted, many of these sections would be new law and would be standing out there as first-timers.
Are there other quick questions of the other teleconference sites or other committee members?
Thank you. This is Representative Holton from Fairbanks. Does the witness have a copy or has he read the House and Senate Joint Journal Supplement dated April 8, 1989, the following commentary from the Alaska Code Revision Commission?
Not that I am aware of. I've read a lot of things recently, but I don't believe that's one of them.
I believe there will be a copy there, pages 64, and I'll comment on the statutory restraints on the dissipation of corporate assets, which is, of course, that you mentioned before. We've got information about a number of suits. I mean, currently, because there is law in that regard, it would seem that having statutes to govern that is
Well, I think the point that I'm trying to make, and that some of the witnesses before me have been making, without coming right out and saying it, is that any time that you have a statute, it's going to be certain portions of it are going to be subject to interpretation in the courts.
Absence of statute seems to do the same thing.
That's true, but case law is, or what we call common law, is basically pretty well established and has been evolved over several hundred years. In a case like this, you're changing what is referred to as the common law, and you're not simply codifying or immortalizing by the legislature existing common law. You're creating law which is contrary to existing common law. And whenever you do that, you create potential court cases where the specific language and the interpretation of the statutes is a matter for the courts to determine.
Have you read the existing California statutes?
No, I have not.
These do seem to be drawn in part from the statutes that we've been given.
There again, I don't claim to be an expert in the matter, but it's my understanding from reading this single document that portions of the California statute are included in this, but that this does go farther in some respects than the California Code as it now exists.
Thank you.
Are there further questions from other people on the teleconference network or other committee members? If not, just before you leave, Mr. Harrison, can I ask you just a couple of questions? How long have you lived in Alaska and practiced lawyer?
I've lived in Alaska 23 years. I've practiced law since 1975.
And one more question, Roger. Out of all of these, obviously, you mentioned that you you represent a number of corporations. How many of those corporations do you sit on as a board member? And generally, I think that's a general practice of an awful lot of attorneys here.
It is. It's one that I try to avoid. I give counsel to the board of directors frequently, as a board and individually, and I give legal counsel to the managers and the officers. As a matter of my personal practice, I attempt to avoid becoming a board member myself.
That question or answer was anticipated. Out of all of these folks that you represent, how many of them, or what kind of a percentage would you say have members that carry O&D insurance?
You mean for the personal liability of officers and directors to creditors?
Well, no. A lot of these, I don't know, you said you represented middle-of-the-road clients. Are there a lot of these, or are there a number of these corporations that you represent where O&D insurance is carried?
I would say I'm not aware of any.
I think that's an important statement to be made here, that if you represent a large block of the middle of what you consider middle corporate thing, and no one presently carries O&D insurance.
Not to my knowledge. There again, you must remember that the majority of the corporations which I do represent have three or fewer shareholders.
Where, in your opinion, because you've practiced law here so long, is the line generally drawn for O&D insurance? Is it because of the activity the corporation is involved in or the size of the corporation?
Generally, the size of the corporation would be my opinion. I believe that would be more of a determining factor than the nature. The larger corporations would be much more likely to obtain that for their officers and directors than the smaller ones.
I don't know how far into tax law you go, but is O&D insurance, when it's carried by a corporation, a tax-deductible item?
Well, I do not have a specialty in taxes, and I think I'd better decline to answer that, if you don't mind, Charlie.
Mr. Henderson, I certainly thank you for taking the time out of your Friday to come down here and share those comments so openly with the committee. I got a lot of questions I could probably ask from the thing, but there are an awful lot of people to go, and once again, I really appreciate you coming down.
Well, I appreciate you, your members, for the opportunity to speak with you.
Representative, I request the committee staff to get in touch with the Department of Commerce and get the data in terms of the size of corporations. I think that'll be an important aspect of judging the impact of this statute. I suspect, as he said, in fact, he was probably conservative when he said just a majority of them are just these three or four people. Could be substantially bigger than I would expect. The Department of Commerce would be able to crank that out for us.
We will make that effort. I'm not certain that they have that to do it, but I've done it before, but I'll make that effort. The next person on the list is Mr. John Abbott.
Mr. Chairman, if I could defer to Professor Daniel Fessler and ask him to make some comments on some of the issues that have been raised.
Fine.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If we're going to talk time available, since the principal purpose of this was to hear people in Anchorage that wanted to comment essentially on his work, and it might be good to ask if those are, and I've noticed people walking out as we've gone through the morning, if there may be those that might not be able to testify.
I was just trying to go through the list as it was written down. I didn't mean to preempt anyone. I would leave that discretion to...
That's a good comment.
I think that is true that Mr. Fessler and Mr. Abbott both, I think, have been involved, and they're here to listen as much as we are.
No disrespect to either of them.
No, in fact, Representative Wendy, we asked to let everybody else testify first. And then
I was just going down through the list. That would be... I appreciate your...
We'd like to testify when everybody else has had an opportunity.
Okay,
to testify,
thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Any attorney wants the last word.
Yeah. There'll be one come in while they're testifying. Let's see. Miss Dickey. No, that's there only as observer, I think. The next one to Richard Reston.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Richard, or Dick Roston. I'm on the task force of the business law section in the bar also, and have been in private practice here for approximately 7 years, representing both large and small corporations and individuals and partnerships and joint ventures. And I think it's a good thing that the Code Revision Commission took a look at our statutes and made several recommendations. There are things which they have recommended which I think should be adopted, and there are other things which I think should at least be thought about some more and then before a decision is made. So I would join the other members in the task force who have asked for an additional 30 days. There are some things which we've had a chance to focus on, and there are some things which we haven't. I had lunch with one client yesterday and dinner with another client last night and was discussing some of these provisions. And you know, the big one which hits them is this secondary liability issue. I think it potentially has a chilling effect on economic development in the state. People are willing to put up so much capital, but perhaps no more. And they are going at risk by putting up that capital to start with. And in some situations, if they go to a bank, they're probably going to have to put a personal guarantee down in addition. So they're at risk there. There's risk. Different parties are going to have to take the risk. It's a public policy decision just where you want to place the risk. If you put a $25,000 minimum capitalization requirement into the corporation code, you're effectively denying people who don't have $25,000 the opportunity to utilize a corporation. I'm just not saying that's neither that's good or bad necessarily. I just want you to be aware of the impact of that. The Department of Commerce was mentioned a few minutes ago. I was curious whether anyone on the Code Revision Commission asked the Department of Commerce for any input on what their thoughts were, what was needed. On the secondary liability, it seems to hit on protecting creditors. Were creditors asked if they felt, where did the impetus, where did the initiative come from for that? The body of law, I think it's very good that Alaska be able to draw on a body of case law elsewhere. We're a young state. A lot of the issues that we face have been faced in other states. A lot of people devote a lot of time and money to those, and it's senseless to reinvent the wheel up here. So if we can draw on the law of other states with similar statutory provisions, I think that's far the better. Some of the people on our task force referred to this thing as the Lawyers Relief Act. Well, I sort of reiterate that we are not looking for ways to make, have more business, make more money under this. I think a lot of us, if there are sensible changes, that's fine. But we don't want to make work for ourselves to have our clients spend money on us. That's not what we view our role as a commercial lawyer. The question was raised earlier about piercing the corporate veil of a foreign corporation. You can pierce the corporate veil of any corporation if the proper facts are there, regardless of whether it's domestic or corporate. As a practical matter, it may be more difficult to find out some of the facts and be more expensive to get at the facts. And even if you get a judgment against somebody else, enforcing a judgment in another jurisdiction can be more difficult, if not impossible. I mean, if you have a $25,000 judgment, for instance, you may or may not be able to find somebody who's willing to go chase after assets in a different state. The also mentioned earlier was where records of the corporations are kept. Some clients I have are very good about keeping up their corporation, and they have good record keeping. They keep their corporate books. Other clients of mine say, "That's what I hire you for. I want you to do it because at least I know where it is. You're organized for that, and I've got other things to worry about." So I think that's something which should be left in the discretion of the individual client. I think a lot of the issues, as I've looked at this, I first became aware of the bill, by the way, at the bar convention where Professor Fessler made a presentation. And quite frankly, I think when we heard that it wasn't going anywhere last year in the legislature, we didn't pay that much attention to it. not unlike probably the revolutionaries during the American War, until it starts to affect your pocketbook, you don't pay that much attention to change coming down the road. It's here now. I think it does deserve attention, and I think it does deserve the report of the task force so that you have the opportunity to consider that. There are a number of issues that the code brings to light and leaves up to the decision of the individuals involved in the corporation, which I think is a good thing. It says these are issues that need to be considered, and under a present statutory scheme, they're not called for. You don't have to consider them, and it leaves the option to go one way or the other. I think that's a good thing. On the other hand, I've been in practice here for 7 years. I represent businesses, and I have not run into insurmountable problems under the present code. But I do think there is a lot lacking in the present code, and I would certainly hope that at least some of the proposed revisions would be adopted. Lastly, I'd just like to mention that as far as the advertisement in the newspaper, I thought that was exceptionally well done. As opposed to a tiny legal ad, this was something that people would really look at and notice, so I commend you for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wimpy.
Listening to your comments, and mentioning your client at lunch and dinner yesterday, because I have to acknowledge that some of my corporate records are on dinner napkins, but not particularly well kept. I'd ask the question, though, how many are on the task force? How large is the task force?
We have 10. We have broken it down into different subcommittees to look at different sections. Again, as Dick Block mentioned earlier, hitting the economic impact as much as anything else. A scholarly review has already been done. We don't pretend to want to do that again. Nothing else. I think if two of them would put everyone to sleep. If one is necessary, two of them would be too much. The particular task force that I'm on is meeting at 7 a.m. next Monday morning to go over this. I've asked people to make sure they review the statute before then, proposed statutes.
Are all 10 members from APGARI?
I believe so.
Yes, they are. Considering the time involved, we had to get a group that was to get together immediately to get this thing investigated. We had to deal with this.
We talked also about hopefully getting input from the Chamber of Commerce, or at least drawing that to your attention. I recommend that also. We can speak for our clients' interest. They come to ask questions, but I think it would also be very good if you can get some direct input from business people without having to go through lawyers.
Yes, I had planned, in fact, that I was going to maybe contact or had a scheduled contact the Chamber about this matter today, but we will. These witnesses, it's my intention to hold this, continue this meeting on until 1 o'clock, and we're going to break for lunch and then come back to if we have more people to testify. But we do intend to get a hold of the Chamber and other members.
Thank you.
Representative Healy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just going over the journal supplement here, in a letter that was to Bill Ray from John Abbott, it was stated here that the proposed Alaska Corporations Code is what they call a middle-of-the-road attempt here. Maybe you could comment on that, and you had said that there were some problems in what you saw, the revisions that they had put forward. Maybe you could comment on that.
I'm not quite sure that I fully understand it. It's middle-of-the-road in the sense that it's not all shareholder-oriented, it's not all management-oriented. I believe that was the intent. That, I think, is a good approach. It's a more detailed statute than many states, which may be a good or bad thing from the amount of litigation which may or may not ensue. I mean, this means to say that in the absence of a precise statute, sometimes issues don't come to light, and you can rely on the common law, which has been developed over a couple hundred years. On the other hand, when you put things down in statutes, sometimes they're answered precisely, and there's no need to go to the courts. Other times you get a very detailed constitution, as it were. And then you worry about, well, what if something wasn't in there? Was it left out on purpose? Let's not. And that's why I think you talk, be another perhaps concept, middle of the road. This is certainly more detailed than a lot of corporation code statutes, but it's hard to predict at this point whether that's going to be more or less litigation in the future.
Yeah, I don't know. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And a follow-up question. We talked a little bit about corporations that were more venture capital intensive, and we also talked about entrepreneurs and getting to more risky ventures. In your opinion, do you feel that the proposed changes in the code are really going to limit the venture capitalists, the entrepreneurs, and that kind of thing proceeding forward?
I do think it will, as presently constituted. But I'm also concerned about the large corporations coming in here to do mineral development, who would be subject to these. It may have an impact on them. I'm sensitive to the point where people contract with a corporation, you know, they should be paid. One of the risks you have, that's a risk they're generally aware of, is that it's a corporation. And you can, if you, it depends on the muscle power you have in bargaining. I mean, a bank has enough muscle power when you're going to get a loan to make you personally guarantee the loan. Whether you have that capacity when you're making your own contract with a corporation is up to the particular circumstances. So there's no magic answer which is going to protect everybody all the time. I'm just, my own feeling on this one particular issue, and I don't want to place too much emphasis on it, but it's the eye catcher for everyone. Is that I think that it is going to have a chilling effect, and it perhaps goes too far in that direction.
Thank you. Thank you
very much. Section 960 of the bill exempts officers and directors of native corporations under the provisions of Section 488. Do you feel that that constitution could be? It would seem to me that corporations. And officers certainly challenged that section in a court, but never got to court under the 14th Amendment. Do you think that would be a good job security for attorneys, or how do you look at that?
Well, I would say it's very likely that would be challenged. And yes, it would create work for attorneys, and I don't know how it would come out.
No, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are there questions? If there are none, I'd like to just ask you the same question I've asked most everyone else. How long have you been in Alaska, sir?
7 years.
7 years. And during your testimony, you mentioned that under present statute, if you really got a legitimate claim or if a corporation, in your opinion, has acted improperly, you can purchase a court for bail and go after it if there's enough money involved in it.
Yeah, I mean,
it's, and depending on the action that the corporation is involved in, anyway. Right?
Yeah, it's a sad fact of life, but oftentimes justice is what you can afford.
That's right.
And whether you can pierce the corporate veil, it takes more work than if you have just the individual out there on their own. But if you get a judgment against somebody, it's not worth much unless that person has money too. And the other thing you have to consider is even if you pierce the corporate veil, sometimes the person's going to be around with assets, and sometimes that person's going to have flown the coop anyway, if you will.
Well, I've done a little bit of business in Alaska over the years as I've been here, too. And oftentimes, as a businessman, you have to look at who you're going after and decide whether it's a risk of continuing in your business, just how much fuss you stir up. You may lose your shirt going after it. This piece of legislation that we've got here, I don't really see that changing that, do you?
No. I think the basic, when clients come into my office and are upset and want to chase after somebody, I warn them that litigation is very expensive. It's a headache to live with, no matter which side you're on. And you ought to think very carefully before you pursue that course. And those basic decisions will still need to be made. And I recommend, I do some bankruptcy law also, and one of the first questions I ask people is make sure you're not throwing good money after bad. Those sorts of decisions will still need to be made if this code were adopted.
I don't see anyone on this list from the court system, but being that you've practiced law here in 7 years, or I presume you practiced law since you've been, can you just give me an estimate from your perspective of what this would do, this piece of legislation is going to do to the caseload at the courts as opposed to the present statute?
It will increase it because anytime you adopt a new statute, more there's more uncertainty, there's going to be more litigation which will ensue. Whether in 5 years' time there would be more or less caseload on the courts is hard to predict, because after a certain number of years, when things have worked their way up the Supreme Court, decisions have come down, things become clarified, and this code does spell out a lot of things which are not mentioned or otherwise ambiguous under the present code. If you are a necessary part of change, and I think if the code overall is a thing worthwhile adopting, that's the price society pays. And I'm chuckling because who's going to make money during it? Well, we all know who makes money during that, but that is just a price, and that's something which you need to consider going into that.
Right. That answer was about like I thought it would come out, too. That, you know, I try to avoid saying that this piece of legislation is a Lawyers' Relief Act, although it...
one of the attorneys in our firm has a cartoon in his office, which I find very apt. It shows two farmers arguing over a cow, and a farmer and a lawyer in the middle milking a cow. So.
let me ask you one more question about this $25,000. I don't exactly how that $25,000 was reached at, whether it was by aid of a dartboard or what, but after this 5 years period, let's just say we make up a scenario here that this thing's adopted tomorrow and we begin this 5 years, is that $25,000, in your opinion, going to be $100,000 in 5 years from now?
Well, I think, because it would be increased simply because of inflation, or for whatever reason.
As a result of these cases that are going to come forward out of this.
I should say that the five-year period, and I guess the one exception to that, is if this code were adopted in its present form, I think the number of cases would not decrease after 5 years under the $25,000. If you can go after somebody for $25,000, you're going to do it. And increasing it to $100,000 would increase slightly the number of cases.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the future impact or the impact on future legislatures. If you do this, obviously, or at least if I was out there trying to whack somebody, I would be putting pressure on legislators to increase that amount. And if I was a member of the Bar Association, I'd be putting pressure on them to increase that turkey so that I could get some dough.
Not necessarily. I mean, I'd like to take exception there. Certainly, speaking as a commercial lawyer, my job is to protect my clients, and I represent clients on both sides. And what I think is reasonable is just that, is a look at the policy behind the statute. It's a social, philosophical decision to reach what amount. And I think there'd be just as many attorneys trying to keep the limit to $25,000 or to decrease it to better protect their corporate clients as there would be on the other side. I think that if you do pass this piece of legislation or something that comes out of this, that it's the legislature... It behooves the legislature to stay very closely tuned over the next several years to the good things and the bad things about the legislation as they prove out, and to be very willing to take a second look at it and not say that, well, we spent a lot of time and effort, now our job is done and we don't have to worry. And I'm sure there'll be people lobbying you one way or the other.
Thank you, sir. I don't have any further questions. I do thank you for coming down here and sharing your comments with us. Representative Winty?
Given the one question, Representative Furness, Lee, this morning distributed a letter from the court system.
I want to make sure you're aware. Yeah, I have that. That's the court system's opinion. I'd like an attorney's opinion. I've practiced here for 7 years, and it goes right along with mine. I think the number of cases would probably quadruple, and I think in 5 years they would probably double again.
I don't know that would necessarily be true in 5 years.
However, I'm sure Mr. Snowden would not hesitate to point out additional caseloads and consideration of his budget, so
he's got that.
They're not known to be too conservative
when
considering their budget request.
He may want to revise his fiscal note after this for his additional budgets.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next person up, Mr. Ray.
We have a question here from Commissioner Brown.
Oh boy.
Yes, Mr. Brown.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to ask Mr. Rossman one question. Also, I would just hope that the members of the task force will be in touch, both with John Abbott, who lives there in Anchorage, but also with Commissioner Jerry Kurtz, because Jerry is the designee of the Alaska Bar Association, and in fact, he's their representative on the Code Revision Commission Mr. Ross, and I hope you know that you may well know very, very well. I just wanted to ask about this mention of problems of a burden of requirement of inspection at the place of business. Are you referring to Section 233, which requires the copy of the bylaws to be at the place of business?
I was referring to what Roger Henderson was referring to, and I don't have the section number right at hand. That would be one instance. Yes.
Okay, that was the section that he referred to. I'm not really sure how burdensome it is to have a few dozen pages of documents in the headquarters office. The other thing, maybe it's a footnote either for committee staff or for Professor Fessler or something, I suggest that maybe the response or comment about the Native Corporations in 960 might have a different answer after 1991. I don't know if anybody's looked into that. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Brown. I'm sure that they will, task force will be in contact with the Code Revision Board.
Yeah, we will. And thank you for bringing that to our attention again.
Thank you. Mr. Ray Garner.
Chairman, the other members of the task force are looking up to express my views.
Okay, thank you.
Straight through the phone.
Stan, is it looks like a doctor? No?
Right.
Thank you. Looking like a...
My name is Reitman, Stan Reitman. I'm an attorney in Anchorage, and I've been here some 20-odd years. And I have practiced in this area at some length and for some time. I'd just like to make a couple of general observations, if I may, without getting any too much into the specifics. Number one, the existing statute is not broke. It ain't. I think any implication that Alaska picked up something off the shelf that was some sort of a absurdity or some sort of a half-baked cooperation code is just not true. The genesis of the existing statute was developed in the 50s and has been kept up to date by a series of amendments over the years, which Alaska hasn't kept up with, unfortunately. And the people that worked on that statute came from a pretty diverse group. There were academics, there were practitioners, there were people in the business world, there were financial types, there were governmental people. And the statute received widespread approval and was picked up by Alaska. For innovation's sake. You don't want to be different for difference just because you're in Alaska. You want to be like the other jurisdictions. If anything, we want to encourage capital to come in here. We want to encourage lenders to come in. We want entrepreneurs to come in. We don't want to have some special statute in Alaska because we ostensibly have special needs. We have some special needs, but they're not that different than they are in Oregon or in New York or California. Now, admittedly, in those two large states, particularly New York and California, where there are literally thousands and thousands of competing forces, they have tinkered or developed their own philosophy. But they can do it. They can go it alone to some extent. Alaska doesn't necessarily want to do that. If you ever dealt with an outside concern that wanted to invest in Alaska and they want to know something about the climate with which they're going to operate, they want predictability. That's one of the goals of any law writer or lawgiver or law academic or what have you, is predictability. And we want to be able to move freely across state lines. Now, whenever you've had a question or an inquiry from somebody in another jurisdiction, or whether it was a bank or whether it was an investor or what have you, we were able to say that we had the Model Corporation Act in Alaska. Now, that was recognized and stood us well, in good stead, as I say. So just get over the myth that we don't have something that's working, because it's not true. It has worked. Now, there are people who, particularly in the last few years, and in regard, I know with the Native corporations, who have found some areas which probably need some beefing up or some change or some clarification. And I know that A number of the practitioners who worked for the Native corporations have participated in this code, but there are many other people who haven't, unfortunately. Now, the second thing I think that's worthy of note is that there definitely has not been adequate consideration to the small corporation, or the small group, the ma and pa, as it was referred to here. In fact, I see, in addition to this liability matter, which has been talked about this morning, which I think is going to create, is definitely going to discourage anybody from using a corporation. Just to give you a quick example, if I was going to start an enterprise tomorrow and I wanted to hire some talent, and one of the inducements for hiring talent is to make that person an official, an officer, or to make that person, or to give that person some stock in the corporation, you'd be a chump, you'd be a fool, you say, to accept that assignment. I mean, you got to have your head examined. And that's what you'll be foisting on unsuspecting people that are going to go into assisting entrepreneur. You know, the creditors are big boys. If you're in the business of extending credit, whether you're a bank or whether you're a materialman or whether you're a lawyer or a lumberman or what have you, you know what it is to grant credit. You're supposed to investigate. You're supposed to monitor. You're supposed to. You're taking a risk, and that's part of the ballgame. So all this great concern about the creditors who are being cheated here in Alaska, I think, is just so much poppycock. They're not. We have adequate tools to get at them. And as indicated this morning, if there's any fraud involved, there's admittedly a road to take, but it's doable. In the small corporation area, or small investor area, one of the tools that's frequently used and very effectively used is a shareholders agreement. It's a treaty, as is referred to in the commentary, a treaty, if you will. Well, I don't know what's wrong with a treaty, but the treaty, if you will, if there's unanimity among the shareholders, is designed to in effect create an operational form that's akin to a partnership, which is very beneficial to the small organization. We're going to have much more difficulty with that. We're going to have a lot more trouble with it. We've got to work through the articles of incorporation, as was alluded to this morning. For example, there's been a swing towards more informality in that if you have less than three shareholders on the existing statute, you can have fewer number of directors. In other words, if you have two shareholders, you can have two directors. If you have one shareholder, you can have one director. Well, that's been knocked up. And that's symptomatic of what I think is the failure to deal with a small ma and pa corporation, if you will. I think that this statute, as it's is going to do a great deal to discourage the use of corporations. Now, if that's what you want to do, fine. You know, the movement in the tax law is definitely towards the partnership. I mean, nowadays, it isn't as important to use corporations for tax purposes as it used to be, because to a great extent, there's what we call parity now in the law. And many of the advantages that you could procure from a tax standpoint at the corporate level is now available at the unincorporated level. And as also, as you know, that for tax purposes now, the corporation, in a form that they call the S-corporation, is in effect a partnership for all practical purposes. But what you're doing here is you're taking away the corporation in its traditional form as a means of limiting a liability for the investor, okay? And I might add, the corporation is a very useful tool for bringing people in and out of ownership and bringing them in and out of management. At any rate, I think that the statute does have a number of beneficial provisions there, but they could have accomplished very much the same thing, ladies and gentlemen, by simply taking the Model Act, which we do have, comparing it with the Model Act as amended at the national level, all right, and seeing those areas where there is deficiencies or there are deficiencies, and then curing them without sweeping this thing away with one big swoop. And I realize that if I were a law writer and I was a lawgiver, I might want to put my stamp of approval or my name on an auspicious piece of legislation. But whether or not the public's going to be served is another question. And I wouldn't be too concerned about this business of the creditors, you know, stealing. I mean, the creditors getting put upon. I don't think that's true. I think what you're doing is you're foisting on us without an opportunity for for a lot of folks who really work and need the tools that are presently available to have a chance to digest the darn thing. Thank you.
Could you spell your last name?
R-E-I-T-M-A-N.
Thank you. Representative Petzinger had a question.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Reitman. It looks like we have the opportunity to try to identify the best of the proposed codes. Well, we have a very practical opportunity, which you've suggested, which is take our original model act and compare it to the to how it's been amended on the national level. Can you characterize what kind of a job we would be facing if we took our existing law and compared it to how it's been amended on the national level? Could you characterize what kind of an effort that would be? And could you characterize any particular or identify any particular areas where you think that we do need to supplement our existing act?
No, well, I wouldn't want to ask the latter question. No, I prefer not to get into the detail on that. I think that the comparison, I'm sure, has been done. I'm sure that logically and hopefully the revision committee and Professor Fessler have done this. As to what would be involved in that comparison, I don't think it would be a tremendous undertaking in terms of scholarship or in terms of man days. No, I imagine it could be done in less than a week, in terms of less than 5 days or something, and somebody who did it.
Well, we have this 30-day problem
right.
with the task force from mm-hmm. the business law section of the Alaska Bar, and
right.
I wonder if that task force would be interested in making that comparison. Now, I can't speak for the task force. They're already mm-hmm. volunteering as it is, and they're taking on a tremendous workload, but I wonder if that maybe isn't a very practical comparison.
I think that's a good suggestion. And it's doable.
Representative Furness.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe Representative Pessinger was reading my notes here. No, I appreciate that. I had a question along those same lines. I think you've answered it. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Russell.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Ragan, how long have you been in Alaska?
25 years.
25 years.
Yes.
I guess I probably ought to put that on the sheet when everybody signs up so I get where they have to ask that question. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next person on to testify, Mr. Bob Baskett.
Mr. Baskett, Mr. Chairman, thank you. All of the comments, in fact, that I was going to make this morning have already been addressed by the previous witnesses, and in the interest of the committee's valuable time, I will... let those comments stay as they are.
Okay, fine. We're back on now. Mr. David, Bendell?
Bendell.
Come forward, please. State your name and spell your last name for the record, please, and state your name.
David Bendell, B-E-N-D-E-L-L. And I'm also a member of the Alaska Bar Association Task Force. I guess my comments primarily are directed, as Mr. Kelly's were, that it is simply difficult, if not impossible, for those members of the task force who at the present time give really any sort of opinion as to the efficacy of the bill, since we really haven't had that much time to study it. Our organizational meeting was very recently, just the other morning, and we're just now in the process of parceling out portions of the bill to be analyzed by various of the volunteers. I'd just like to make a few comments. The first one is, I guess, a couple of comments have been made here today that this might be a lawyer's relief act. Well, in my case, I think that's really quite on point because I'm a bankruptcy lawyer, and this is really going to be a relief act for me if this thing gets passed, because all these directors and all these officers are going to come knocking on my door after and they're going to say, well, you know, I've got all these debts, and I got to get out from under, and I'm going to put them under. And as to whose benefit that's going to be, I'm not entirely sure. All I can say is I'm not really looking for that kind of relief. The second point, I mentioned I'm actually practicing near bankruptcy securities. The second concern I have, and it's something that we most particularly want to analyze during the 30-day period, which is why we think it's essential, is the effect that this type of bill is going to have on public offerings of stock in the state of Alaska. As I'm sure many of you are aware, whenever there's a public offering of stock, there has to be a document prepared, a very lengthy document known as an offering statement. And that has to elucidate what are known as risk factors, risks associated with the offering. I would assume that any offering of any stock of any corporation that's going to operate and do business in the state of Alaska is going to have listed as a risk factor for potential stockholders the fact that we have this rather peculiar law in the state of Alaska that in essence, does away with limited liability. And my concern is, and as I said, my opportunity to review the bill has been minimal. My concern is what effect this is going to have on the ability to sell such stock. We talked about getting input from the Department of Commerce and from the task force. I think we ought to get some input from people who are securities dealers and find out what they're going to, find out if they can sell anything from the state of Alaska if we do this. Are the people in New York, when they see an offer from the state of Alaska to develop oil and gas or fisheries or anything that's going to make jobs in this state, are they going to say, well, we can't sell this, we're not going to touch anything from Alaska because we're concerned that we're going to get sued by investors and stockholders because they end up getting tapped with this liability problem? I think it's an area of concern. It's something I think we all like to look at. I think the one final comment I'd like to make is it has to do with experience. The people who are affiliated with the business law section are people who work in business all the time. We've all been through shootouts involving lien priorities and tax liens and adversary proceedings in bankruptcy. I think the joint experience of the committee would be invaluable to this committee in deciding whether this is a good bill and deciding what type of bill. I think that Mr. Kelly's comment of the essentialness of the 30 days is very valid, and it's something we would humbly request.
Thank you. We have no problem with that. We intend to extend that time. Any questions
from Fairbank?
Representative Kofi?
Thank you. Do you think that New York or California corporations have any difficulty in selling stock?
Well, it's my understanding that they have not yet adopted this type of act. And right. It's something they're talking about.
We have they are in statute.
I'm not entirely sure.
1977 revision of the California Code, and in New York it goes back to the Dutch.
Well, I'd like an opportunity to examine that. I'd like to examine what type of effect this has had on public offerings, specifically the extent that limited liability is being done away with respect to shareholders. And that's something I'm not entirely sure of. Like I said, it's difficult for us to comment at this point because I think the business law section was alerted to this just a very short time ago. I got a call from Paul Kelly, I guess around 2 weeks ago, who was, he was very concerned. He was making a flurry of phone calls to the various persons who over the years have been involved in the Business Law Committee and in our CLE programs. And I've just very recently got a copy of the act. And as to what the effect has been in New York and so forth, I guess that's a real good question. And maybe the best way to answer that question is to call some underwriters in New York and lawyers in New York and find out what their act says and what effect that it has had on their offerings see if this is something we want to do. I think, you mentioned New York and California, and like as I said, I haven't seen their enactments, but I think the key thing we've got to keep in mind is this is a developing state. This is a frontier. Our needs to have new money and new people to come in here and build a state are much more important than, let's say, a state like New York, which is, immensely populated and already has very substantial development.
You might ask Professor Petzner for the background. I understand he's there. I also understand that he did give a presentation to the Bar Association. What is the status of the task force? Have you been designated by the Society of Governors or part of the Business Law Section of the Anchorage Bar or the State Bar?
We are an ad hoc committee of the Business Law Section of the Alaska Bar Association, which is as you may be aware, most bar associations have sections which are committees of lawyers which deal with the new developments in the law, and in particular putting together educational programs for lawyers to educate them in new developments in the law.
Thank you. Yes, I'm aware of that. Is that the ad hoc section of the Anchorage business law section, or is it statewide?
I believe it's statewide. I think Mr. Kelly is the statewide coordinator of the Alaska Bar Association business law section.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative
Buster. I have that same question, Mr. Bendel. How long have you been in Alaska?
I've been here for 6 years, practicing for five.
And then where did you come from Alaska?
New Jersey.
Did you practice in New Jersey?
No, I didn't. Cambridge?
Where did you go to law school?
Rutgers.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next witness up, Mr. Brian Bundeen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Brian Bundeen. I'm a lawyer with the firm of Hughes Thorson Skance Powell Bundeen. We practice law in Alaska in the Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, and Valdez offices. Yes, I've been in Alaska 33 years, and I've practiced law for 18 years. I'm a CPA lawyer, and I involve myself primarily in the area you're dealing with today. I have, as I grow older, I have less inhibition against expressing my own opinions, and so I'll do that for you.
You always have.
Mr. Reitman said it, I second it. The corporate law of Alaska is not broke. I really didn't know that it needed any particular fixing. My own personal bias for law is this, that if something needs to be done and there's a public request for it, then there's a reason to do it. And there have been over the years public requests for some changes in our corporate law. But when you come down with a whole brand new one, I'll tell you what the result will be. And that is, and I represent, by the way, national, international corporations, down to the mom and pops, the whole range. And the experience will be this, that the national and international ones will hire me and others like them to fix whatever problems exist in here for them. The mom and pops will get it in the you know where. Because they'll get caught with things that they're not aware of. They don't have lawyers they go to except when they get in trouble. And when they're in trouble, it'll be too late. Well, didn't you know the law changed and what you were used to is no longer so? Oops, no, I didn't. And many of them, the in-betweens, and we have in Alaska's business community a lot more in-between. No mom and pops, no national, internationals, lots of in-betweens. And many of the in-betweens have in these recent years found that wholesale changing of laws costs a lot of money. I'll give you one example that some of you may have experienced. Congress has changed the laws regarding pension profit-sharing plans two or three times in the last 5 or 6 years. Under ERISA, you've heard of that, under so forth. Tax laws are changed constantly, you know that. Every time one of these changes happens, and I have clients who have pension profit-sharing plans, they've had to amend them twice for no good reason. And never were doing anything wrong to begin with. But the law required they amend them. Every corporation will have to be changed if this becomes law. And those who will have to do the changing, most of them haven't done anything wrong, don't want to do anything different, have never cheated anyone out of anything, and won't. But they'll have to incur the cost or run into one of the traps, one of the speed traps down the highway, if they don't change their laws. That's practically what will happen. And that goes as well for this one that seems to gather more comment today, and that is a secondary liability. I suspect the other provisions in here are going to cause really much more trouble over the years for the reason stated that many of them are new, and I think if you stay with model acts, you're much better off. But on the liability matter, there really is no different, in my view, from saying if a president of a corporation or a secretary is going to be liable, why not a manager of a partnership? who is not a partner? Why shouldn't he be liable? Why not a manager of a sole proprietorship? If the reason for making liability is an assumption on your part that the president is the owner and can determine how much money the corporation has to pay its creditors, that's an error, isn't it? Because he doesn't fund the corporation, he's hired. Similarly, the manager of the grocery store that is not incorporated is hired. He really can't control what the owner does, how much money's in the business. If he's going to be liable because of management decisions instead of how much money is there, why then, I guess, any employee of any organization ought to be liable for any of his decisions up to $25,000 to every creditor. It makes just as much sense to me, if that's the reason for it. So I think passing a law that supposedly fixes this social problem, it concentrates on corporations, must have some basis other than someone's thought this is one way to fix something. It goes far more than that. If the reason for it is, if you're going to be responsible for your decisions, then everyone in every organization who makes decisions should be responsible, not just corporate officers. If I were in your place, I would put the law aside until someone says, section so-and-so is troubling me, I'd like that changed. And then I'd look at section so-and-so. What you do if you adopt this completely is that the sections that won't raise points today, I expect before this would get passed, if it were passed as is, there would be some changes to this liability section. But there's 5 or 6 or 7 sections back here that no one's excited about today. They're going to cause someone an awful lot of trouble next year or the year after that nobody thought about or talked about today or in the next couple of weeks or in the next 30 days for this task force that weren't broken to begin with and didn't need to get fixed. And you're going to fix somebody, though, for reasons unknown today why it should be done. I'm keeping it short and sweet.
Thank you, Mr. Dundeen. Representative Wimpy.
Hey, Brian, well, there is... It's your opinion that every set of articles and corporation statement has been revised this bill passed?
From the brief reading I've given of this, yes.
Any House members, anybody out in the network care to, any questions? Representative Furness?
Just want to say, Mr. Chairman, I've known Brian for many years and I certainly do respect his opinion.
I do have a tax comment I wanted to make, too, if you'd allow.
Yes, please.
When we put the Professional Corporation Act into law in Alaska, we first did that, we put a section in that left the professional liable, period. We had a tax problem with that, so we had to amend it and say he's liable only for his own malpractice. That's the way the Professional Corporation Act done. That was done, and I think the same would occur here on this liability thing. The Internal Revenue Service, if it finds that we have a corporation act that says, if you are, as many Alaskans are, the owner, the officer, and the director, if you're liable for $25,000 per creditor, friend, you don't have a corporation. And that's what the IRS will say. And so those small corporations, if this law were passed as it now says, who are corporations for tax purposes, are going to find they're not.
Thank you. Representative Bessel?
Yeah, thank you, Brian. That was really my next question, since you said you were a CPA attorney. What was about that? What it, and the other question I asked earlier was, is O&D insurance, is that a corporate?
I guess half of what our law firm does is known as an insurance defense firm. From what I know of it, there is now no director's liability insurance available in the United States. I've looked into that personally. There is not a director's liability policy available. There is one sold, which people have bought, but there has never been a successful claim made against it. I asked the guy who wrote it whether anyone had ever, it comes out of Chicago. He said, nope, and that's because it doesn't cover anybody for anything. There is no assurance that I'm aware of which protects businessmen in any shape for their debts, except bonding. And that's not insurance.
No.
And when you have bonding, the comment earlier made is quite correct. They'll bond you if you give them your personal assets and the like, which case bonding is simply an added additional cost factor to the liability. since you pay the bill yourself anyway.
Brian, can I ask you to explain to the committee just what a bond is? I know what it is, but I suspect most of the committee doesn't know what a bond is and how it works if you try to exercise it.
I think the clearest analogy is like you guarantee someone else's debt. You guarantee someone else borrows from the bank, you guarantee it. You have to pay it if he doesn't. That's what a bond is, only it's done on a more formal basis.
That's right, and they take the bond holder, the guy they sold it to, completely to the cleaners before
right.
they begin to exercise. That's the important thing about a piece of fire, about a bond. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chairman. I'd like to ask you, Mr. Dean, did you see her ad in the newspaper?
No, I didn't.
Thank you.
I missed something pretty good, apparently.
Any more questions, Mr. Bundy? Thank you, Mr. Bundy.
Thank you.
I think we're going to make the deadline here. We have one more witness, I think, or besides the board, Mr. Bill Cook.
He's not
here? Well, he's left then. Professor.
Chairman Cowdery, we had one additional witness who was unable to sign up on the sheet.
Yes,
he can come after Mr. Adam, I guess. Might as well let Mr. Adam testify.
If you'd like to come forward for at this time, we'd appreciate it. State your name, spell your last name, and the affiliation.
My name is Mark Copeland. I'm an attorney here in Anchorage. I've been in Anchorage. I first came out in 1960. Actually came back again in 77 and practiced law since that time. Practiced law since 67. My name is spelled Copeland. I would basically concur with Brian Brundin's statements. And rather than repeat them, I would like to just add a couple of quick comments. One is there's been a lot of concern about unsecured creditors reaching people who use corporations to avoid their liabilities. Those same people, whether they're incorporated or not, will avoid their liabilities, even if they have to move out of state and go in business in another state. So you're not going to catch up with person who truly desires to avoid his liabilities. I would emphasize that the bill as written is just a trap for the unwary. There are provisions in the bill that we haven't talked about, including provisions with regard to reports as to inside transactions between members of the corporation's shareholders and the corporation. I doubt very much that most people in Alaska would recognize the fact that they have two different businesses as involving an insider transaction without a lot of discussion and a lot of education by the bar. So those people are going to find that they failed to meet a statutory requirement. Similarly, they're going to find foreign corporations that have the same problem. I find it really amusing that the entire section or the entire commentary goes back to New York and California law. I have never heard people who intend to enter into business deliberately seeking out the New York or California codes. Basically, the people seek out a Delaware code or another statute that has a long history of business activity and which appears to provide the limited liability that is so important to capital formation and to getting into business. Someone touched earlier on Section 450, which provides a negligence standard. This is even more extensive than the apparent secondary liability standard of Section 488. And once you give a lawyer a negligence standard to go after, that's everything. You can sit down and make a business decision as a member of a board of directors, and it turns out that you weren't right. Now it's merely a question, were you right because you were negligent, or because you acted in good faith, but you were wrong? And negligence could be anything from you didn't spend enough money to go out and research the new area you were going into, the amount of funding it would take to build your new building or some other reason. And what you've done is you've opened up a very expensive litigation section. Just one comment on, I was reading page 140 of the comments, I guess, and I guess maybe it says it all. It says here, as early as 1848, the state of New York addressed the interest of employees and others to look at this limited liability question or the secondary liability question. I have not made a survey of the states, but I believe that what we're being asked to look at here is something kind of like the Edsel. It's unique. But this one's been around since 1848, and a large number of other jurisdictions and bodies have looked at it and have not rushed out to adopt this proposal. This is a major change in the social and economic philosophy of corporations, and I feel that we should wait and see what happens. The concept that was talked about earlier about whether or not there's some shareholder liability, there may not be shareholder liability, except to the extent that oftentimes an officer director is also a shareholder. And I thought Mr. Reitman's comment with regard to anyone that accepted the job as a president of a corporation in Alaska, if this were passed, just be out of his mind, is absolutely appropriate. I also wonder about the personal secretary who, under this act, happens to sign, be the corporate secretary, and she's making maybe $24,000 a year and finds out that she's just mortgaged the farm or the house or whatever it is. And to fairly look at this act as a complete act would be very difficult. I favor the other approach, which is let's find those sections we don't like, change those.
Thank you. Are there questions from the labor and commerce side from here? Any questions from Fairbank?
Commissioner Brown has a comment.
Yes, Fred Brown, Fairbank. I was asking if the next witness or one of the next witnesses is going to be Professor Fessler, and some of the attorneys who just testified have time that they could catch at least some of his remarks. I assume he's going to respond to some of the matters that have been mentioned here. I know that they have busy schedules and probably have other engagements, but if that's at all possible, I would hope that there could be some kind of a dialogue established.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Brown. Any more questions for the witness? Thank you. It's approaching 1 o'clock, and we had tended to break from 1 till 2:30 now. Here for the pleasure of the witnesses here. If I know some of the committee has appointments for lunch with various other people in town, so yeah, it'd be the pleasure. I would sit here
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Might I suggest that we invite the witnesses to come back at 2:30?
That would be. That's what I was doing. I'd hope that.
Mr. Chairman. Somebody who has been working with the Code Revision Commission on this bill for 4 years.
Chairman, could you step up? We can't hear him.
Yes.
We come up to the mic at this time.
Yes. I am Dan Fessler, and I've obviously been playing a role in the working on the drafting of this bill for some 4 years. I'm here from California this afternoon. I'd be very happy to return at 2:30. You've heard many comments this morning, some of which I think raise questions that are policy questions which only you can address. Some of which, because perhaps of the admitted paucity of time that the witnesses have had, have involved statements about the content of the bill which are simply flatly inaccurate, and I would not wish the committee members to be under the illusion that they were. And also, I think that I would like to have the opportunity this afternoon, if it is the committee's pleasure, to respond to questions from members of the committee. So, of course, I'll be back here at 2:30, but for many of the very busy members of the House, this would be the first time in 3 years since this bill has been pending. It was first introduced in March of 1982 that we will have had an opportunity to directly supply information and to answer and respond to questions. And so I look forward to that opportunity, sir.
We look forward to seeing you at 2:30.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll adjourn recess this meeting until 2:30. Yes.
Is it your intention to come back with more testimony on this bill, or were you going to go to other subjects at 2:30?
We're going to stay with this and then go to the other subject as time permits.
Do you have an indication of how many people are left to testify?
On our list, just the co-commissioner.
My understanding is that the network down here is going to be tied up for something else, so we probably won't be able to tie into that.
Okay, well, we will certainly have transcriptions of all this testimony, so if it's not possible for you to tie in, we'll fill you in Monday.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate the opportunity to tie in up to this point, though.
Yes, I thought it was very interesting. Thank you.
This is Fairbanks.
We'll
be continuing with the two-wire service.
Okay, fine. This time we'll sign off.
We were
at this time, and three members of the Judiciary Committee are here. Anyway, then are we back on? Yeah. We're reconvening the meeting, continuing from the morning meeting. We had one more witness on Mr. Fessler, the Poet Provision Commission. If he would come forward at this time, and we're dealing with House Bill 343, an act revising Alaska Corporate Code. Fessler, if you would please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, for the record, I am Dan Fessler. I'm a professor of law at the University of California at Davis, and for the past 4 years have been retained by the Code Revision Commission as its consultant in first surveying the state of existing Alaska law, determining the potential need for revision, and then acting as the person who has done the technical work of drafting the value judgments made by the members of the Code Revision Commission. I'm appearing here this afternoon with John Abbott, a member of the Alaska Bar, who is the chairman. And with your permission, Representative Cabrera, Chairman Abbott had some remarks that he wished to make before I spoke.
Yes, I would like just to announce we have some other people on confirmation that this, we intend to get right into that as soon as we're through here. So if you'd just please stand by, we'd appreciate it. Mr. Abbott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of both of the committees. I'd like to preface my remarks by saying that we are here today. We do have under consideration a rather complex piece of legislation. And it does need to bear full scrutiny as far as the Code Commission is concerned. What I would like to do, however, is just briefly dispel any misapprehension on the part of the committee members as to whether or not this matter was adequately noticed, and I can assure you that it was. The Bar Association has been represented on the Code Commission since its inception in 1976, when this bill was first taken on as a code revision project. The Bar Association requested, both formally and informally, input from the Bar Association and specifically from any business law committee that could be convened to consider this. In May of 1982, the Bar Association, through its then chairman of the Business Law Committee, Mr. Dick Block, who was the first witness to appear here today, specifically requested that the Code Commission provide Professor Fessler as a speaker to explain the bill that's now in front of the joint committees today. That was done in December of 1982. At that time, Mr. Dick Block was still the chairman of the Business Law Committee of the Bar Association. There have been repeated efforts, both formal and informal, to involve the Bar Association in deliberations, in seeking input from them on the drafting, the implementation of this corporation's bill. It's inconceivable to me that anybody could argue that the Bar Association was not put on notice of what we were doing with the bill, did not have any idea what was happening with it, or that any of the members could claim that they didn't know or shouldn't have known that this bill was under consideration. Be that as it may, they've asked for a certain amount of time to review the bill. With grave reluctance, I will say on behalf of the commission that we would acquiesce in a 30-day period with review and would hope that the joint committees would hold firm to that 30-day period. As Representative Malone earlier pointed out, that may or may not be the death knell for this particular bill. And we are pushing hard for consideration of this bill this year. You've heard a fair amount of testimony concerning the existing Alaska law and the new bill. and I'll let Professor Fessler respond to the claims that it's innovative or radical. It is not. Input on this bill has been provided by me and by Commissioner Jerry Kurtz, who represents the Bar Association. I have been in Alaska since 1969 and have practiced law since that time. Commissioner Kurtz has been in Alaska since 1961 and has practiced law during that time. We both have extensive background in private practice dealing with corporation and corporate abuses. And it was our opinion that there were significant abuses which cried out for a review of this law. And again, the